Naturally Speaking.
I'm Lori Baker. This is Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Seabird biologist Dr. Richard Phillips is recently back from a three-month research trip to the coldest, driest, and windiest continent on average, Antarctica. In South Georgia, he and his colleagues at the British Antarctic Survey study the population and evolutionary ecology and physiology of seabirds, including albatrosses and petrels. Richard, welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Thank you.
When did you decide to become a biologist?
Actually, I didn't initially when I was at school. I was interested in lots of different subjects, and then I was lucky in a way that at Glasgow University you can study quite diverse things in the first year. So I did biology, chemistry, and archaeology, and it was only then, as I was doing biology, that I realised that the aspects of zoology were really the things that interested me most, and then I went on to specialise in zoology.
Can you remember your first trip to Antarctica? What were your first impressions?
Ah, yes, that's right. Well, it's very exciting when you're doing your first trip, and in some ways it's really nice to go back there with other people as well who are going for the first time, because it does mean that you're continuously reminded of what it was like. And it was very exciting. You go down to the Falklands on a military airplane, and then you get on the bus ship, because to get to South Georgia you can only go by ship. And that the most exciting thing is in the Falklands you see your first Magellanic penguins and you see some southern giant petrels flying past in the harbour, and so you're getting a feel for Antarctic wildlife. And then as you head through on the ship you see icebergs for the first time at the day or two later, and then eventually you get to, in my case, got to Bird Island, which is where I was going to do most of my research. And the interesting thing is you can smell Bird Island before you can see it, just because there's such a mass of wildlife on there, lots of seals and seabirds. And so it's a really interesting experience, partly for all your different senses, you know, both what you can see and what you can smell.
What kind of training do you undergo to work in this type of remote and extreme environment?
It's assuming you already have the qualifications in terms of the research background. Then what British Antarctic Survey do is they set up a briefing conference where you go and you learn a bit more about what life would be like on base and what your jobs would be there. They tell you, they remind you about things to do with what medical cover you have, or indeed you don't have. There's no doctor, for example, at Bird Island, so you have to do a first aid course as well, and you do a field course as well. With learning things to do with use of ropes and so on. Although reality is that at Bird Island you don't really go near the very high cliffs, so you wouldn't use that skill. But all these other things are just to give you a good feel for what the environment's going to be like when you turn up.
And is there a lot of snow there? Because you go technically in the sort of Antarctic summer.
That's right. Well, it's varied a lot from year to year. The first year I went, there was a lot of snow on the ground until well after Christmas time, even though it was the summer there. And then in subsequent years, there's no snow on Bird Island when I arrive, and it'll snow maybe a few days during the season, but it doesn't lie. But that's because Bird Island is off the northwest tip of South Georgia, and is a relatively small island and so relatively warm. But on mainland South Georgia, there's permanent glaciers, and from Bird Island on most days, when it's really bad weather, you can see these glaciers and these snow-capped mountains in the distance.
Your work focuses mainly on two seabird species, albatrosses and petrels. How have they adapted to live in this seemingly inhospitable environment?
There's albatrosses and petrels they've got a number of adaptations. I mean, first of all, the feeding grounds for many of these species are very distant, so they've actually got a very economic way of foraging that means that they don't use much energy when they fly. So, in fact, an albatross uses less energy flying probably than it even does sitting in the water when it has to thermoregulate. They have very thick plumage, which keeps them warm. They reduce the prey to a very energy-rich stomach oil, which means that they can return after a long foraging trip and feed this really energy-dense meal to the chick. And they've got various other ways of... their life history is such that they breed relatively slowly. It takes a long time for them to learn enough about the foraging areas, where the foraging areas are located that are around them, so they don't maybe breed till they're 10 years old, but it means when they do breed, they can feed relatively efficiently and effectively.
And what has been the most exciting discovery your team has made about these birds?
that's a hard question. I think, in general terms, And the last decade or so, there's been a huge revolution in tracking technologies, so we've understanding a huge amount more about where the birds go and why they go there. So we can track now with the GPS loggers. We can put them on, 30 birds during the same breeding stage of, say, of one species of albatross, blackbird albatross, say, and then within, a 2 week or 3 week period, you can find the information on exactly where these birds have gone from the GPS on the backs, and then on the legs, we can deploy a small saltwater sensor that detects saltwater, and so every time they land, you can get the timing of the landings, and so you can tell how long their flights were, how long they took between landings, how long they landed in the water for when they're trying to find food. You can see that they rest overnight on the water. And so really it's our understanding of foraging ecology that's changed a lot in the last few years.
And I was very interested in your seminar yesterday when you mentioned that there was one of the birds that had a Guinness book.
That's right. So one of the grey-headed albatrosses that we tracked, so there's a bit of background to the story is that normally when you use satellite transmitters, you get fixes that are erroneous. So and that's largely just to do with errors in the satellite processing of the signal. So we run a speed filter normally, and you set that at maximum speed of, say, 80 kilometres an hour, and then identifies locations where the bird is moving faster than that you then double check to make sure that they're not erroneous, which normally they are. So we ran this speed filter on one of the tracks from a grey-headed albatross coming back from the Antarctic Peninsula to South Georgia, and all the locations from the Antarctic Peninsula to South Georgia were flagged up as being, unbelievably fast. And then, but we actually know we recovered the device not long after the bird had returned, and so we actually know that that was the time that the bird returned at. And it turns out that it had been flying in the teeth of an Antarctic storm, and it had travelled at more than 100 kilometres an hour for 10 hours, absolutely as straight as an arrow, which shows their incredible navigation abilities, all the way from the Antarctic Peninsula to South Georgia, which is more than 1,000 kilometres.
Wow. And do you know how they navigate?
Well, actually, that remains one of the unanswered questions, actually, in seabird ecology. I mean, they certainly have a map and compass navigation system, so they know where they are as well as where they want to go. So that's unlike some more simple animals that do use path integration, which is they know they can basically sum the bearings and the distances they sort of travel to get to where they are, and then they kind of effectively reverse that to get back to the colony. But in albatrosses and other seabirds, they probably make use of star maps, maybe a magnetic sense, polarised light, and there's some evidence as well that they use olfaction. So they don't necessarily able to smell the wind coming from the colony, but the idea is that there's an olfactory landscape all around them, and they can know roughly where they are.
Albatrosses are an endangered species. What are the biggest threats to their population?
There are 22 species of albatrosses, and in fact, it's the most threatened family of birds. The main threats are that for a few species, they're threatened on land by introduced predators. There's one classic example is Tristan albatross in Gough Island, where the population is threatened by introduced house mice, which prey on the chicks, and so their breeding success is really poor. And in the Indian Ocean, there's a problem with avian cholera on Amsterdam Island. But those are relatively rare, these terrestrial threats. From all, more or less all species, there are problems. The problems for the birds are in the high seas and in national waters where they get killed in fisheries. And that's a whole range of fisheries. So this includes both longline fisheries, which are set for tuna and billfishes and bottom-dwelling fishes on continental shelves, trawling for the species that interact with trawlers, and gill nets for the species that come close inshore.
And what is being done to mitigate these effects?
Well, there's a lot of work being done by conservationists there has been in the last few years to try and do something about these issues. So there's an international agreement called ACAP, that's the Agreement on the Conservation of Albatrosses and Petrels, that brings together scientists and representatives from fishing organisations to a meeting once every year or every 2 years, and also ACAP functions as a forum to bring together all the data that's available on population trends and distribution and bycatch rates and so on, to try and get a kind of a scientific basis for the development of strategies to both to improve our knowledge of albatrosses and petrels, but also to improve engagement with fisheries management bodies. And indeed, BirdLife International as well, which is a global conservation NGO, non-governmental organization, they've got albatross task forces in different countries where there's high problems with bycatch, and they have people that are trained to go on board vessels and tell the fishers about different ways that they can reduce problems with bycatch. And so there's both a grassroots approach, like as the BirdLife Task Force, which engage with the fishermen themselves, and then at higher levels, there's people from ACAP and BirdLife and other global NGOs as well that go to the meetings of big regional fisheries management organisations and so on that are responsible for fisheries over the high seas.
And I was interested that you guys had been using some of that tracking data to also inform what areas were most at risk.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's been one really very useful practical application of tracking data in the last few years, is that we can map, and we because we know so much about the distribution of birds, we can then relate that to what we know independently about the distribution of fishing effort, and so we can work out at what times of years, which species, and in which areas in the world are there's most likely to be a potential problem from the birds interacting with the vessels and potential bycatch, and then we can go and focus on those areas to check whether there's any observer coverage to see whether someone is monitoring bycatch rates, and then potentially if there's good mitigation and good monitoring, then you can rule that out as a potential problem spot. But if there's no good information on bycatch rates, then you can try and get observers on board vessels in those areas.
And it seemed like the group of bird species that was hardest hit was actually the juveniles.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's hard to know why exactly that is. Either the juveniles stay in certain areas for more of the year, and meantime the birds are returning to the colonies to feed their chicks and incubate their eggs, and so are not vulnerable for so long in terms of time-wise, or maybe the juveniles are more susceptible to being bycaught. You know, they're a bit clumsier, a bit more naive, and so perhaps they're more likely, if they try and steal a bait off a longline hook, they're more likely to actually get hooked and drowned.
What is your advice for young ecologists hoping to enter into this field?
I think if you do well at school, for a start, if you want to get into university and do the degree that you're most interested in, of course that gives you the option of a wider range of universities and so on. And then if you're at university, it's really good to get some useful practical experience as well, try and help out with research projects that other people are running. If you want to work on birds, getting a British Trust for Ornithology ringing license is also a really good idea. So all these things just set you apart from the crowd when it comes to job interviews or PhD interviews.
And do you find that you draw on a lot of quantitative skills as well?
Yes, I entirely agree. I mean, I think nowadays it's not sufficient just to be a good field biologist. In the end, you have to analyse data sets, and these data sets now are huge. If you're going to look at tracking data, for example, there's many and different complex ways of looking at habitat preference of the birds. So you're often going to be trying to overlay tracking data with remotely sensed satellite remote sensed data on sea surface temperature and chlorophyll and location of fronts and so on. And so even in that realm, it's really useful to have good quantitative skills. Similarly, if you're going to look at population dynamics, then you have to understand how to calculate survival rates from resightings of marked animals and that sort of thing. So yes, quantitative skills are essential these days.
Is there anything you would like to add?
A particular interest of mine is in albatross conservation and seabird conservation. I mean, I think it's really important that people try and understand where their seafood comes from. So I think if people were more careful about ensuring that the fish that they ate came from a sustainable stock and a fishery that's certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, then we could do a lot to put pressure on fishing organisations to improve the standards with which they operate. And be much better for the environment, and much better not only for the fish stocks that would be maintained, but also for reducing bycatch of other species.
Thank you for joining us on Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter @thenspodcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.